Hi, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Programs Broadcast. I'm Dr. Brad Reedy. Today is January 11th, 2022. This book was recommended to me by one of our listeners to ask me to do a review on it. So I'm happy to do that. And I think that for our audience, for the people that listen to this podcast, I think there's going to be a good place for this book in our recommendations in our library. I think it'll be good for a lot of parents that are new to therapy, that are beginning to understand what it means to be trauma-informed, what it really means to understand what's beneath the symptoms, what's beneath the behaviors. Like a lot of books that I read sometimes, the title says it all. And I'm going to start off with that idea from the story that gives you the idea about where that title comes from. This is the longest piece besides the ending page that I'm going to read to you this evening during the broadcast. But it goes something like this. The title, What Happened to You, signifies a shift in perspective that honors the power of the past to shape our current functioning. The phrase originated in the pioneering group of Dr. Sandra Bloom, developer of the Sanctuary model. In Dr. Bloom's words, we, the treatment team for Sanctuary, were in a team meeting sometime around 1991 in our inpatient unit, trying to describe the change that had happened to us in recognizing and responding to the issue of trauma, especially what has become known as childhood adversity. As a casual issue for the problems of most people, a causal issue for the problems of most people that we were treating. And Joe Federo, Joe said, he was always good at pithy observations and said, it's like we have changed our fundamental question from what's wrong with you to what happened to you. Oprah and I, this is of course Dr. Peary speaking, Oprah and I are convinced that asking the fundamental question, what happened to you, can help each of us know a little more about how experiences, both good and bad, shape us. Our hope in sharing these stories and scientific concepts is that every reader will, in their own way, gain insights to help us all live better, more fulfilling lives. You know, I thought about this when I was reading this book. I thought about it when I first began to be a wilderness therapist back in the mid-90s. And as I came in, this was, you know, in the literature. It was in my education, this idea that our symptoms and the patterns that develop out of those symptoms are born or arise out of some wound, either chronic, one time, maybe it was a theme in our family, but essentially we were to trace those wounds back to that original, trace that behavior back to the original wound. And so that was something that was taught to me in graduate school. It didn't feel like a new idea. In fact, the information that I was being presented was 20 or 30 years old at the time, at least, if not going all the way back to Freud. You know, that was Freud's original premise, is that if you talked to people and allowed them, mostly listened to people, and allowed them to tell their story, then the symptoms that they were displaying would dissipate over time. That's a core concept of psychotherapy. The primary and founding principle of psychotherapy. Today we'll talk a little bit about brain science, which has given us clarity and more structure to our understanding about what I'm describing. But that was the essence of psychotherapy. So what surprises me about this book, in fact, at one point during the book, Oprah refers to Dr. Peary's work as groundbreaking, is that we keep breaking the same ground over and over again, that we keep forgetting that the symptoms that we see in our children, in us, anywhere from something as small as reacting with anger, being triggered and acting and lashing out at somebody in a moment, to something that's more significant, like suicidality or self-harm or substance use disorder, that all of those things have their roots in underlying pain and discomfort. So it reminds me, and I hope will remind the listeners to the broadcast this evening, that it's so easy to forget that the symptoms do their job in masking the wound and distracting from the wound, from the pain, from the sadness, from the grief, from the hurt, from the fear. You know, Carl Jung, a protege of Sigmund Freud's, said that it is that our neuroses, that our behavior, our symptoms, are substitutes for legitimate suffering. And what, of course, that suggests, of course, to the practitioner or to the client, or to anybody who reads it, is that we go back and give those wounds a voice, give them a safe place to be spoken and to be heard. And so it must be in human nature. It must be in our nature to be fooled by the symptoms, to be distracted by them. And I know all of you who have children or a loved one, a brother, a sister, a parent, somebody that you care about deeply who has suffered from a mental health issue or an addiction, all of you can relate to how angering and triggering and frustrating and exhausting that behavior can be, those symptoms can be. And how easily we can change or turn from compassion into anger and punishment and retaliation towards the other person. Like we often hear that the cliche that the people that need the love the most are sometimes the hardest ones to give it to. And that doesn't escape our children. You know, the relationship we have with our children, sometimes in their most, the times that they need our compassion and our love the most, we are less apt to give it. Because remember, if we see through the symptom, if we see into the wound, then the person suffering will be reminded of it and asked to feel it. And like Jung suggests, it is easier to express yourself through neurosis or neurotic behavior, symptomatic behavior, than it is to actually legitimately suffer and feel. And it reminds me of my first exposure to children in the wilderness, to young people in the wilderness, when I learned that everybody needs to learn how to feel their pain. I thought, and I've said this many times, my job was going to be to make people feel happy, when really my job is to help people feel their sadness and their pain, their frustration, their anger, their hurt, and so on and so forth. He begins with a very, Dr. Peary begins with a very simple story about a veteran of the Korean War who now is home many years later and married, and recently experienced a strong panic response to a motorcycle backfiring. And his wife or partner, meeting with Dr. Peary, asked the question, but doesn't need that response anymore. I understand how that duck and cover, that hypervigilance, that overreaction to the backfire, I understand how it served him in Korea during wartime, but he doesn't need it anymore, and it's actually making his life miserable. Can't he just unlearn it? And Dr. Peary, of course, says, that's a great question. The tricky part is that not all of these combat-related memories are in the parts of the brain Mike can consciously control. So our traumas, big and small, and I'm gonna refer to big T and small T throughout the broadcast this evening. Big T are those obvious ones like suffering sexual or physical abuse, death of a loved one, being a combat veteran from war. Now, those are big T. Everybody looks at those and knows that trauma. And small T is more subtle. Small T might be being picked last for the kickball team. It might be having a learning disability that you or nobody else has named, and feeling anxious and going to school and having it you know, being found out that this great fear that you have inside that you're not smart might be exposed. Small T might be a parent lashing out in frustration at a child when the child makes a mess. Those kinds of things that we consider kind of the norm for human existence, that's small T trauma. But what Dr. Peary begins to explain to Sally and Mike Roseman is that so much of our experience is stored in nonverbal parts of the brain, are stored in that lower part of the brain that manages our nervous system, right? That manages our flight and fight responses to threats. And so you can learn about it, you can read about it, but to unlearn it is an arduous process. I say this all the time when talking about trauma, big T or small T, and asking our students, our clients in the wilderness, to explore it and unpack it. I say to them all the time, you didn't cause it, but it's now your responsibility. Now you carry it around in your body and in your brain. And you can't choose, like in the example of Mr. Roseman, you can't choose not to be triggered immediately by the backfire of a motorcycle driving by, where you hit the dirt and bring everybody down with you, hit the ground and bring everybody down with you. But you can, over time, work through it. That's where it changes from choice consciously, like Sally's asking about, to ownership, making your project. And since every single human being has experienced some trauma, big or small T trauma, everybody has the responsibility to work on themselves. Otherwise, your reactions are unconscious. Joseph Campbell says, if we don't explore our trauma, we end up calling our lives and our decisions fate. They are inevitable. We in essence, give up our agency, give up our choice by not owning the wound, by not owning the trauma. And everybody around us and we ourselves suffer because of it. So let me talk about some of the lessons from the book as I go forward. What do we get out of the book? Oprah tells the story of getting some water. She lived with her grandmother most of her life, and going and getting some water. And her grandmother observed that Oprah put her hand or her fingers in the water when she was getting it for the family. And then when she came back in, not really even conscious or thinking about it, her grandmother confronted her. And when Oprah either denied it wasn't very clear because she didn't remember it or she didn't think it was a big deal, her grandmother whooped her, spanked her. And that was part of her upbringing. That was a regular part of her upbringing in the culture that she grew up, that you would be beaten with a switch if you acted out. The long-term impact, Oprah says, of being whooped and then forced to hush and even smile about it, because that's what her grandmother would ask her to do, turned her, Oprah, into a world-class people pleaser for most of her life. So our parents, or in this case, grandparents, act out on us and then don't even want us to feel the pain, the sadness, and the anger that we feel. And then we wonder why our children have a hard time with peer pressure, have a hard time being assertive. We wonder why our daughters end up in abusive relationships, why our sons end up in abusive relationships, why our children end up in situations where they don't stand up for themselves. Because in some ways, they learn this from us. I'll talk more about the implications for treatment as we go along and what the healing looks like toward the end of the broadcast. But Oprah, Mr. Roseman, these are stories where Dr. Peary explains that this is how the brain functions. It gets stored or programmed or wired into that primitive part of the brain. And then when something approximates the original trauma, when somebody gets angry with us, we resort back to our old behaviors, the behaviors that in our childhood were adaptive. And now we are calling them maladaptive. It's why it's a great irony that you know, parents send children to our program because of symptoms, of course, because they're struggling, because they're suffering, because their life is either at risk, being threatened, or they're just in a stuck and in a broken place. And then what we ask them to do is to talk about their feelings, starting with you, the parents. I've shared this before, but it's been a while. My wife and I had our son go on a private wilderness trip a couple of years ago. And we wrote the same first letter that we ask parents in our programs to write to the child about the reason for sending them there. We call it the hopes and intentions letter. And I remember vividly my wife's letter. She shared it with me. She said, "It's not lost on me," she said to our son, "the irony that we sent you to a program to get rid of behaviors that are there in part to protect you from the pain that we caused." And I thought that was such a heroic offering of my wife's to my son. She was essentially saying, "We know we hurt you, and we know the way you're managing that pain has become diagnosable. It's become a problem. It's become maladaptive. And we're willing, as a mother and father," she was implying it was going to work, that I was going to do the same work, which I was, although she read it, she wrote it much more poetically in that first letter. "We're willing to lean into that experience and have you talk to us about how we hurt you." Oprah also tells the story about how she slept with her grandmother for the first several years of life. And her grandfather, who had dementia, came in one evening and threatened her grandmother so seriously that they thought he might hurt her severely. He was trying to choke her. He was in a disoriented state, and they actually had to call a neighbor over to help rescue. And Oprah said, even in her adult life, living in Chicago, on the 57th floor of a building with security and a doorman, she was afraid to be alone at night. Because these are not rational things. These are stored. These are wired in the primitive brain. Dr. Peary spends a great deal of time, and I'm not going to spend nearly as much time as he did talking about this upside down, this bottom up idea of the brain. The brainstem is that lower primitive. It's the first part of our brain that develops. Sometimes it's called the reptilian brain because it's so primitive and basic. It manages temperature, respiration, heart rate, and so forth. And that fast-acting, fight, flight, or freeze part of our brain gets wired when we are exposed to trauma in such a way that it protects us from getting hurt in the future. That's what fight or flight is about. And we don't get access to the cortex as we move up, literally move up from the bottom of the brain to the top of the brain. We move up through our the parts of our brain that manage sleep and arousal, appetite, movement, reward, memory, bonding, emotions, and eventually to that part of our brain, the cortex, the prefrontal cortex, the top and front part of our brain that manages creativity and thinking and language and values and time and hope. One of the points that Dr. Peary makes that I think is a really good point is that since the primitive brain or the brainstem has no ability to measure time, when that backfire goes off for Mr. Roseman, or when Oprah's sleeping on the 57th floor of a luxury apartment building on the river in Chicago, since the brainstem can't measure time, the experience in both of those instances feels present and imminent and threatening. And again, you can give people information. You can teach them about this. And that's part of what this book does. That's the best part of this book is teaching you, mom and dad, husband and wife, partner, friend, grandparent, teaching you how the brain works so that when you look upon a child who's struggling or a brother or a sister who's struggling, you can maintain compassion and perspective. You can understand what is needed, rather than punishment or lectures or even simple psychoeducation. What is needing is a healing art, a healing experience. And it takes time to deprogram the brain, to unravel this at first adaptive function of the self to now what has become maladaptive. you know, what's missing from the book. I thought about this as I was reading, because I think it's a really solid book that does a good job of changing the question from what's wrong with you to what happens to you, to changing it from, again, a symptom focus to a trauma focus, to help us understand neurologically what's going on for people that are struggling with the disorders that we treat. I think it does a great job with that. But I always want to, when I do a book review, talk about the limitations. And one of the things I notice with it is that the stories that he tells are very specific and simple. I think they're great stories that illustrate the point. But in almost every example of every story, I kept thinking to myself, the story is much more complex than that. You know, he would talk about, you know, brothers or twins or siblings living in the same house. And one of the principles that I know as a family systems scientist is that no two children have the same parents. No two children have the same experience. That there's an infinite number of variables involved in each person's life. And so the story that he offers, the examples that he offers are quite simple and specific and concrete. And we need to think of them is just illustrations. I think really what he does, what they do, I should say, because Oprah assisted him in this book, what I think they do well in this book is they do what I don't do in my books. They get very technical and exact and exact and kind of show you a clear flow chart. Whereas I speak much more abstractly. I use my stories and I think they become obvious that they're more illustrative than they are specific examples. The other thing that's lacking throughout the book that I was really surprised by is attachment. Attachment is the quality of the relationship between the parent and the child. It's much broader and deeper than big T or small T. It's the tone in the family, the energy in the family, the ability of the parent to attune to the child and to respond to the child's needs. He talks about it. They talk about it a bit, but they don't name it as attachment. And I thought there was a fascinating point that they made later on in the book when they talk about attachment without naming it, that I think really speaks well to the kind of work that we do together in these broadcasts and in our program. I think there could have been a more subtle and nuanced understanding of the attachment trauma. You know, at Evoke Therapy Programs, both our intensive programs and also our wilderness program, we espouse attachment theory, attachment-based therapy. Even the relationship that I have with my client, whether it's a teenage boy or a middle-aged woman at the intensive, I begin to mirror or replicate the experience with the parent, how I feel toward the client gets known by the client unconsciously. I try to create competing experiences for the client so they can re-experience themselves. They don't really talk about that. More subtle, you know, the attachment is kind of the way that it feels in a family, the way that a child feels around the parent. It, you know, I talk about this quite clearly in The Journey of the Rogue Parent, that what a parent not just says, I think that's what Dr. Peary and Oprah talk about. It's not what a parent says to a child that becomes the child's inner voice. It's more what a parent feels toward the child and how they think about the child. If you think of your child as the problem, it doesn't matter what you say. The child will experience themselves at some level as a problem. That is why anxiety in a parent can be so harmful and toxic for a child. Because that worry constantly communicates to the child unconsciously that something's wrong with you. And if you don't get better, I, the parent, won't be okay. And if I'm not okay, you're not going to be okay. So I think they miss some of that. They talk about it a little bit later, but they really don't dive into it too much. I also think for parents that read this, I think it's a great introduction to trauma. I really do. But I also think for our more advanced parents, I think the part that would be missed from this book is that it's not that simple. Because a lot of you will look back at your child's life. I can't tell you it's an innumerable amount of times that I've been told by parents in my career, my child had a pretty good life. You know, we didn't, not that I'm aware of, there was no big T trauma. Some parents will even go as so far as to say it this way, like they don't really have a right to be angry or mad because we had a happy family or a good family. And I think this book leaves a gap there for parents who think that. It doesn't help them understand that it's a more subtle, more human process that is not just marked by these big moments that are noticeable, but by the, like I said, the infinite numbers of interactions. He also doesn't talk about the process of therapy. Ironically, this book is not written by therapists. You know, this book is written by scientists and by Oprah, who I found out through this book, said in this book that she's never seen a therapist, which shocked me actually. She said she talked about her best friend Gail King and how they bounce ideas off each other. And I, you know, I was thinking to myself, I know that there's lots of ways to skin a cat, so to speak, right? I talk about this all the time. Sometimes you can do it in 12-step support groups. You can do it with a mentor, a sponsor. Really close friends who are informed with this kind of work can be that kind of support with you. It's hard for me to imagine somebody writing and leaning into this kind of work as long as Oprah has done it and never having gone to therapy. I had to read that sentence 2 or 3 times to see that I was reading it right. And so the book is psychoeducation, but it really doesn't talk about how to create a healing experience for the child outside of just taking away the trauma and giving the child warmth and nurturing. And that's just a fraction of attachment, right? Attachment is safe and attunement, but it's responding to the child's needs. It's managing your own regulation so that you're not upregulated, being able to contain the child. All of those aspects that we talk about on this podcast, on this broadcast, week after week after week. This is where I think it kind of gets interesting in the book. I'll read this to you. They write, "Our major finding is that your history of relational health, your connectedness to family, community, and culture is more predictive of your mental health than your history of adversity." This is similar to the findings of other researchers looking at the power of positive relationships on health. Connectedness has the power to counterbalance adversity. Our second major finding is that the timing of the adversity also makes a difference. And I'll talk about developmental psychology in just a moment. But to highlight this point, the quality of your overall connectedness and relationships can mitigate trauma. Ironically, that was what my dissertation discovered. That's what we looked at. We looked at children of divorce and children of with alcoholic parents. And we wondered, was there any variable in their lives that would mitigate the effects of these two trauma experiences, these adverse childhood experiences, as they've come to be called? Could anything mitigate it? And there was one specific area in our research that we found, and that was if somebody identified that there was a consistent person who saw them, who was there for them in a meaningful way during childhood, then the divorce or the alcoholism didn't have a clinical effect on them. They had equally healthy relationships in young adulthood. These were young adults we were studying. They had equally satisfying relationships, healthy relationships in young adulthood to those who didn't experience the trauma. In fact, those who didn't experience the trauma were oftentimes, we could split those into two groups also, where the ones who didn't identify having a connected person in their life had lower satisfaction levels in their adult relationships. So again, this is not new information, but it's great that it's coming from somebody in popular culture that is so revered by people in our country, in our society, by so many people. So you know, Dr. Peary spends a lot of time. I think one thing he does really well that I don't focus on a lot is he talks about the timing of the therapy. Excuse me, the timing of the trauma. You know, if it happens in the first year, the first 2 years, the first 5 years. You know, Freud posited the idea that the younger the trauma, the more globally impactful it would be on the child. And Dr. Peary's research supports that idea. That's what developmental psychology understands, is that those early stages become the foundation on which you build. And if those early stages have cracks or mold or termites in them, taking the metaphor even further, then the aspects of the self built on top of that will be on a shaky foundation. And they do a good job of giving examples of different kinds of trauma experienced by children at different ages. But the hopeful thing is how you are as a family. Can you listen? You know, it goes back to a really fundamental principle that I teach all the time, and I love it when neuroscience catches up to kind of what we know as therapists experientially. That the relationship, the quality of the relationship, is a greater predictor. If you can listen to the child, hear the child, you don't have to be a perfect parent. And everybody dents their child in some manner, big or small. You cannot escape that. The only thing you can do to make a difference in the child's life is to let them feel it, to let them be angry, to let them be sad. I talk about this all the time. The person expressing the trauma is the one that gets to decide if it's trauma. You don't get to decide if somebody else's experience was traumatic or not. They get to. And when we encourage our young people to write, you know, difficult letters, we call them impact letters, to the parents, when we invite our clients, our young clients, to write those impact letters to their parents, you know, it's the beginning of the healing process. And it's really hard. I've received those letters. I've sat in therapy sessions with several of my children telling me things that I didn't see or necessarily agree with. The very facts I disagreed with. But that's how you discover it, is you have a safe place to talk about it, to sort it out. You know, the way I would talk about my mother and father when I was 16 is not nearly, it's not the same way I would talk about them today. But I needed that freedom to explore. And the messages we receive and we hear in popular culture sometimes even in the therapeutic community, the people that want to go back to history are wasting time. They're playing the victim. That is just nonsense. The science disproves that idea. And our favorite writer on childhood development, Alice Miller, makes it clear that we only have one weapon. One weapon. One enduring weapon in our fight against mental illness, and that is the discovery of the unique emotional history of our childhoods. We have to go back. We have to see why we're showing up this way. It's the same principle that when you walk into Al-Anon and they teach you, if it's hysterical, if you're overreacting, quote unquote, if your reaction is disproportionate to the situation, logically speaking, then it's historical. That's what that means. And Dr. Peary in Oprah's book does a great job scientifically explaining that. So this is a great book for those who like to hear the science of it, who don't necessarily trust what we therapists sometimes, or those of us who have been in recovery, what we think is self-evident. That's not good enough. Because there's been a lot of so-called experts over the year that have proposed ideas about raising children and relationships in general that they've claimed has been self-evident, that has been later disproven. So the science is catching up. I remember I've told this story before, and I'm going to read another section of this book. I had a staff where I was explaining to the staff one week, don't confront the student during his hopes and intentions letter when he expresses his anger and his frustration. Let him feel it. One particular instance was a young man, teenage boy, complaining about his stepfather and how if he met him again in an alley that he would kill him because he had been abusive. And everybody wanted to, of course, that was triggering to everybody else. So they wanted to probably because of their own relationship with anger and their own family rules and roles and the flavor in their family, the energy in the family, they wanted to shut down that anger, that threat, and talk him out of it in a very nice and gentle way. And I had to explain to them, we just listen. And the staff said to me, when they pulled me aside, but don't we eventually have to tell him that that's not the solution? I said, eventually we can get there. And they said, when? And I said, well, I'll tell you when it's not. I'll tell you when we don't confront him and tell him that. We don't confront him and tell him that when he's reading, to some extent, a history of his own trauma to relative strangers for the first time in his life. We definitely don't do it then. We wait until his nervous system is downregulated, and that's when we start offering ideas. And that can take hours, days, weeks even. And this one staff came back to me later and said, you know, but listening is not enough. You know, if two siblings were abused and they told each other about it, wouldn't make a difference. And I said, first of all, you're wrong. It wouldn't be everything if nothing changed. You know, it wouldn't be complete healing and transformation, but it definitely makes a difference. And I love this section of the book that I want to read to you. Dr. Perry writes, you've probably heard of the Romanian orphans. It is likely that more than 500,000 children spent part of their early lives in the state-run institutional orphanages at a certain point in Romania. When communism ended in the country, the public and press saw the horrible conditions these children had been subjected to. There were often 40 to 60 babies or toddlers in a single large room, each in their own crib all day long, with only one or two caregivers rotating among them over the course of a 12-hour shift. The children suffered deprivation, malnutrition, abuse, and more. Even after being removed from the institutions, they grew up with a large range of deficits. And this is one of the points where he's making where when these kinds of experiences, these kinds of traumas are experienced by children at younger ages, it has really damaging effects for a longer period of time over a lot of areas of their life. Even after being removed from the institutions, they grew up with a range of deficits. Some had low IQs, others couldn't walk. Most had major problems forming and maintaining relationships. I work with many children removed from these orphanages. In general, the longer the child was there, the longer the deprivation, the more serious the problems. And I thought this was an interesting observation. Ironically, in some overcrowded institutions, children who had to share cribs ultimately did better. Think about that. Just the proximity of another human being, another baby who can't talk, who can't listen. Just that, we can't even really call it an attachment. We'll just call it proximity. That human proximity. Just that dampened the effect. Dampened the effect of the trauma on the child. So what do? When somebody comes to us with a mental health diagnosis and disorder, we revisit. We ask them to tell their stories. And we do it in small bits and pieces. One of the most important thing, especially for parents who have children in treatment or loved ones that are struggling with mental health disorders, the most important thing is you can't force it and you can't rush it. It has to come. To some extent, it has to come on the timeline of the patient or the client, not on the timeline of the parent or the spouse of the loved one. Dosing is the term that Dr. Perry refers to. Dosing means taking it in small doses and doing it where the child or the adult is able to opt out of it or change the conversation. Because, he explains, as you're saying, if you control when and how much you the traumatized person talks, it can be re-traumatizing rather than healing. I'm going to read that again. Because, and he's responding to Oprah's question, because, Dr. Perry explains, as you're saying, if you, mom and dad, husband and wife, friend, sibling, if you control when and how much a traumatized person talks, it can be re-traumatizing rather than healing. That's why so often when I'm dealing with somebody with chronic trauma or big T trauma, even small T trauma to some extent, I'll say to the parents, we can't force it. When I was younger in my career, I did not understand this principle. I re-traumatized clients. I was not taught this, or at least I didn't absorb it in my training in my school. And it was only after time, several months, that I began to see the harmful effects of forcing a child to confront their trauma. Sometimes that happens when a mother has a co-parent or a father has a co-parent that they believe is the primary source of their trauma, and they want that child to talk about the co-parent, the abuse. But you don't get to decide. And if you take control, if you force it, you essentially re-traumatize the child, because an essential element in healing from trauma is the client's ability to maintain control over when and how much the story gets talked about. And just backing off, just the act of inducing or forcing, provoking the client to talk about it, or removing that provocation, just those acts can make a big difference in outcomes. I think Dr. Perry and Oprah do a great job of telling a story about humankind that helps us understand the child, what they needed that they didn't get, and what they need going forward. I think that what they need going forward, they're a little bit light on. And that's where we therapists come in, right? Because we are more than just, I write about this all the time, we're not just psychology students, ideally. I hope. Psychology is the study of human behavior, and therapy is the way, a way of being with somebody. I can understand about the knee ligaments, right? I can read a book and understand about how knee ligaments work and how they can be stretched and ripped and torn and broken. But the therapy, giving somebody physical therapy, is an act that I do with them. Right? It's something you do with your clients. And the information, therefore, is not a substitute for therapy. See, I think so much of us parents, we're so unaware of our unconscious. That's really what it is. We're so unaware of how powerful our preconscious, which is kind of like a, you know, when you're kind of half awake and half asleep, when you kind of have a feeling that your preconscious and your subconscious or your unconscious is underneath that complete unawareness. We're so unaware of what's down there, of what energy is what's fueling our behaviors. And we're unaware of it because haven't explored it. And in many ways, for many people, I've learned is we don't want to explore it. My therapist makes this point all the time when I'm presenting a case to her. She'll say to me, often in a German accent, quoting one of her professors, the client will be the last one to know. And that's what it feels like sometimes when I'm giving parents or partners an update, an analysis of their loved one. I'm describing what's going on and why, telling the story. But I'm also saying they don't have an awareness of this. This is going to take time. I want you to know it, but it's going to take time. And if I go back into the field and just tell them the way it is, I've said this to you before, what's it like when a therapist offers an interpretation to a client before they're emotionally ready to to talk about it, to feel it, to own it. The experience is that the therapist doesn't understand me, which is the exact same way a client feels when the therapist doesn't understand them. So you don't know. You have to be careful. You have to allow the client to set the pace. And just know that giving them a book or psychoeducation or a picture of the bottom-up model of the brain and explaining how trauma gets stored and how it prevents our creativity and a higher level of functioning, just explaining that doesn't repair it. The Korean Vietnam vet that I described at the beginning, he wasn't cured. When Dr. Peary wrote this little diagram, this upside down triangle on a napkin. But it helped them to understand this is the project. This is your project, mom and dad, husband and wife. That's the project. It's to understand, you don't have to have big T trauma, but to understand yourself. And part of yourself is understanding the wounds and why you're triggered and why you get reactive to certain things, why you get angry and frustrated disproportionately to the events, why you snap. Oprah even uses the word snap in the book. She said that in the book, she said, that's an aha moment. When we talk about people snapping, we're talking about that moment where the fight or flight takes over. They talk about resilience a little bit. And they write, so children need challenges to build resilience, but the stress of the challenges has to be just right. And the scaffolding and support has to be in place for the child, or the child will get dysregulated and fail. In which case, rather than building confidence and resilience, you risk eroding self-esteem or worse. I want to make this as clear as I can, and it might not sound like it makes sense to a lot of listeners, but I want to be clear. Resilience is founded on a secure attachment. In other words, a parent's ability to see and to hear a child, to really see and hear them and to respond to their needs adequately. That's attachment. Seeing and hearing the child, understanding the child, having compassion and patience, clear boundaries also, but compassion and patience. And so, yes, having challenges in your life can be a part of that, but you have to have the scaffolding. That's what they're calling attachment experiences. You have to have scaffolding. And just having challenges won't necessarily do it. You have to have somebody there who can psychologically contain you, can hold you. And I'll explain that a little more using their words. I thought this was interesting. I just thought it was an interesting note. It reminds me of why sometimes I notice when I read self-help books, the difference between therapists who write self-help books, who understand the art of therapy, and self-help authors who are researchers or social work researchers or scientists, psychiatrists, and so forth. Oprah writes, she's talking about Gail King. She says, I have been her therapist. She has been my therapist, speaking of their relationship. And then she says, I've never been to an actual therapist, but I think our relationship as we run through everything that's happening and switch back and forth between what's on my mind and what's on hers. I want to be as open-minded as I can to the many ways that we can accomplish this idea of repairing traumas. Like I said, using friends, sponsors, mentors, support groups, podcasts, meditation, exercise. But I'm of the ilk that there's no substitute for therapy. Because see, therapy is the great risk. It's the great challenge. It's the risk of walking into somebody's office and telling them the truth about yourself and hoping deep down inside that the therapist won't respond to you the way that other people in your context have responded to you. Oftentimes that's just being different than the parent, not responding with advice or solutions or shutting down because you feel threatened, being patient, listening. It's not confronting. therapy, I did think therapy was largely about confrontation when I was young. I was praised for it in graduate school. And now I realize the goal is to go as fast as the client can go and no faster. And when you push a client or the parent of a client or anybody that you're trying to provide, facilitate healing with, when you push them too far, too fast, you drop it and back up instead of doing what the parent did, which would look like in a therapist of getting defensive. What it would look like in a therapist is justifying their approach and their intervention. I just had a friend tell me the story where a therapist kept beating the same drum in therapy, and the client, my friend, was saying, "This doesn't work for me. I don't want this. I want something different." Of course, the therapist thought that he knew the answer to life and he was going to impose it on the client, and he couldn't shift it up. He couldn't say he was sorry. And because of his own insecurity and the lack of work that he had done to heal his childhood wounding, he couldn't be human. He couldn't be wrong. He had to protect his ego, and he just beat the drum louder until my friend fired the therapist. That's why it's so important in our program that when our clients get angry with us, that we practice, we develop a practice of honoring it, because they're taking a great risk. They're challenging the authority figure, who again approximates mom and dad and other caregivers and teachers, other adults. The therapist is a stand-in for those people, and they're supposed to react differently. That's why I teach you so often that if you want to know if you have a good therapist, tell them when you're mad or hurt. And if they listen and honor it and even celebrate that you would have the courage to tell them that, that they would feel honored by you telling you that, then you have a good therapist. But if they try to re-explain themselves, as most will, and try to make you wrong, as most will, many will, try to make you the problem, that's because of your diagnoses, that's because of your issue, that's because of your misinterpretation, that's because of your faulty thinking. I remember meeting with a young man some years ago at a treatment center, doing kind of a courtesy visit for some parents I had worked with. And he had been taught and was capable of reciting back, regurgitating back, that he had a twisted idea about love. And then when he finally admitted that, he started to turn the corner, and I asked him about it. And he said, "I just think that when people love, I used to think," he said, "before I got told that I was wrong, that when people love me, that they were trying to get something from me." And I said, "You weren't crazy. You didn't have twisted thinking. You have loving parents that I really care about and love, but they have a great deal of anxiety. And yes, they are often taking from you. There's often a transactional, an emotional transactional element, dynamic in codependency. I give, but I want something back. You didn't imagine that." And the fact that he was told to deny that by a therapeutic team and punished unless he admitted that infuriated me. And I said to him, "You weren't crazy. You weren't wrong. It was a valid experience. You still have to deal with boundaries and behavior, and your acting out is still a problem. But I want you to know that that was real, what you thought and felt." I talk about the word containing. They use a different, they're not analytically trained. So they use a different term, and this is what they write. This is what Dr. Peary writes. He says, yes, answering Opus Crescent, yes, it's best if you can simply be present with the child in healing, to help a child heal. If you do use words, it's best to restate what they're saying. This is called reflective listening, the exact same thing we call it in our program. You can talk someone out of feeling angry, sad, or frustrated, but you can be a sponge. Excuse me. You can't talk somebody out of feeling angry, sad, or frustrated, but you can be a sponge and absorb their emotional intensity. If you stay regulated, which means if you stay calm, ultimately they will catch your calm. Dysregulation and regulation are contagious. And what a containing means is you take in the distress of another, the story, the feelings, the narrative, the anger, whatever it is. You take it in. You metabolize it. And you reflect back to the client a sense of okayness. This is what he's describing. If you stay regulated, ultimately, they will catch your calm. It also helps us to use some form of rhythmic regulating activity to keep yourself regulated while you're doing this, like taking a walk, kicking a ball back and forth, shooting some baskets, coloring side by side. There are dozens of rhythmic ways to help us regulate. He just talks about how our life is rhythmic, how the infant experiences the heart rate and the movement of the mother in utero as rhythmically soothing to the child. When we rock a child, when we hold an infant, right? When you see autistic or autism spectrum individuals rocking back and forth, they're trying to replicate this the way the ocean works, the way that the trees blow. He says there's something in nature that's rhythmic, that soothes us. I wanted to end with this story tonight, and I thought it was so powerful. Oprah writes this at the end of the book. She said, years ago, I played the character, I think it was Setha. I think I pronounced that correctly. I might not be. Years ago, she says, I played the character of Setha in the film version of Toni Morrison's searing novel, Beloved. Setha was a former slave haunted by the horrific death of her daughter, Beloved. In the film, Beloved returns to Setha, reincarnated as a disabled child. Setha takes her into her home. For the rest of her life, Setha does penance to Beloved as their relationship becomes more and more debilitating and intertwined. One day, we were shooting a scene where Setha was supposed to tuck Beloved into bed. The only instruction I got from the director, Jonathan Demme, was, okay, tuck her in. And so I walked to each corner of the bed and folded the blanket down perfectly and tucked it under the mattress. Cut, Jonathan yelled from behind the camera. Oprah, you're not tucking her in. And so I repeated the process more purposefully, tucking each corner of the blanket under the mattress. Cut, Jonathan walked over to me. What are you doing? I'm tucking her in. I could feel, Oprah said, a mix of fear and embarrassment rising inside of me, but I didn't know why. You're making the bed, he said, not tucking in your daughter for bed. And that moment, something clicked. Deeply, I stared at Jonathan. I don't know what tucking in means, I said quietly. I don't know how to do that. Finally, we both understood what was happening. Jonathan gently taught me. I'm sorry. Jonathan gently taught me how to circle my daughter with loving tucks of the blanket. As we moved around the bed together, I was hit by a flood of grief. I don't recall ever being tucked in. I never felt anyone place a blanket on me with that kind of loving intention. That must be what a mother's love is. The reason I like this story, the reason it touches me so deeply, because it's such a simple and beautiful way of explaining how sometimes the things that we do to our children are because we just didn't see it. Nobody showed it to us. And it wasn't because they were bad. As I've explained before, we're all traumatized children who were raised by traumatized children. There's no shame in this work. There's no shame in this healing. And so I'm not here to pick on you parents, and I'm not here to pick on your parents or their parents or so on and so forth. It's not about shame. It's just about us understanding what happened to us or what didn't happen to us. And we can heal. If we have the courage to unravel, if we have the courage to walk past the sentinels that stand guard, that tell us to turn around and go back and not look in there, not look in the dark cave, in the dark forest, in the deep water, and find where we were hurt, find where we were left, and to speak it to somebody who can listen and observe it, absorb it. I remember I told this story a while ago. I was interviewing somebody who does a lot of public speaking, a lot of great work on social media around psychoeducation. And I asked the question, like I often ask people, like, how do you do self-care? What do you do for self-care? And to expand on my question, I asked, how do you make sure that you're taking care of yourself so that you can be there for the people that you love, your family and your clients that you serve? And the professional with a PhD said back to me, I don't carry anybody else's pain. And I thought to myself, well, that's a strange thing to say. And then I remembered they had explained to me earlier in our conversation that they don't do therapy anymore, that they just teach. And then I figured it out. If you don't listen, it's easy. If you're just teaching, if all I did was podcasts and write books and post some nice quotes on social media, that doesn't come at a great cost to me. But to listen to somebody's pain, to hold it, to not erase it or make it better. Like the first story with the young man that I referred to as Adam in The Journey of the Rogue Parent, sitting on the broken fence in the rain where he was talking about his mother who had died. I couldn't talk him out of his pain or his grief. I would have made it worse. I just sat there on the fence crying with him in the rain. I carried it for him. I absorbed it. I contained it. What are the take homes? I think it's a great book to get the big picture of trauma, brain science, and human behavior. I think it's a great introduction. Comprehensive, complete. It's great for if you have somebody in your life that really loves the scientific language, even to add to your therapeutic vocabulary, it's a fantastic book. I said this, it's great for those who struggle with the abstract and general nature of my writing and teaching sometimes. The biggest complaint I got early in my career was, hearing you talk makes me feel bad about myself, which was horrible to hear. I don't hear that anymore because I think I do a better job of being on the same level with you, of saying we're all struggling here. But the thing I get more now is I need you to be more specific. So if you like specificity, this would be a good book to add to your library. I think it can lead us to think in too specific and small and concrete of terms. I think it's overly focused on big T trauma. And by that, I'm really talking about that it doesn't identify what we do still today, how we treat our children today, yesterday, and the day before. Parents and caregivers who read this book might miss what is happening or what has happened due to the fact that this book focuses on really big, dramatic, big T trauma events. The language of attachment isn't in here, and attachment is the fundamental glue that kind of pulls all this together. Even he referred to it when he talked about the nature of connection, but he's not trained as a therapist. Again, he's not trained in childhood trauma. He might be trained as a therapist. I might be wrong about that. He didn't sound like a therapist to me. He sounded like an educator and a researcher, a teacher. And the approach in the book is kind of an example of the problem, is that he uses explanation or cognitive intellectual understanding. And for me as a therapist, that's not the same thing as healing. All right, I don't have time for questions, so I'll just get to upcoming events. Remember, The Journey of the Heroic Parent and The Audacity to Be You, my two books are available on Amazon and Audible. We have support groups for families. This is a nice place to get connection. Support groups for families. both current and former family members. January 13th is our next one at 6:30 p.m. Mountain Time. Once a month, these meetings are just for alumni, people that are a little bit farther along. January 25th, later on this month, is the next one, 6:30 p.m. Mountain Time. If you are an intensive alumni, your next available support group is February 8th at 6 p.m. Just contact Malia at evoketherapy.com for more information. If you want to do a deep dive into your work, if you want to do this work, like unravel, dive into it, understand how your past is affecting your present relationships, Finding You is the place to go. Our next in-person one that's available is February 23rd. We also have an online option that's cheaper, and it's over the weekend. So if resources, both time and money, are a factor for you, online is a fantastic option that does great work. Contact intensives at evoketherapy.com for more information. We have attachment-based therapists and staff that do coaching. That is video and phone coaching across the country. So if you want an Evoke attachment-based therapist or staff to do coaching, contact coaching at evoketherapy.com. Our Pursuits Adventure Trips are 3 to 30-day programs for young adults or families. Think therapy light or sober fun. We ask all current parents to attend 6 12-step support groups. Al-Anon, CODA, Families Anonymous, or Adult Children, you can Google those and they'll have meetings both in person and online. Also, refugerecovery.org and NAMI.org are great places to go to get free resources and classes and support in your local area at the local chapter. All of these broadcasts are available on your favorite podcast app and Spotify. Just search Finding You in Evoke Therapy Podcast. You can also go to soundcloud.com on your computer and listen there. You can find Evoke and me, Brad, on Twitter and Instagram using the handles at Evoke Therapy and at Dr. Brad Reedy. And also our intensives program is on Instagram using the handle at Evoke Therapy Intensives. On Facebook, you can find us by searching Evoke Therapy Programs or Evoke Therapy Intensives. And of course, our blog has wonderful content each week. Thanks for joining me. I hope this was helpful. I hope that for those of you who listen to this that feel like it's a great book, that you pick it up and it's helpful for you. But more than anything, for those of you that watch live, those of you that listen to the podcast later, thank you for and behalf of the people that love you, for your willingness to learn, to see how you're participating in the dilemma and the dance with the people that you care about, for your willingness to do the work, for your willingness to go into the cave, for your willingness to go into the office to tell the truth and take the risk of being seen. My next broadcast will be January 18th, a week from tonight at 6:30 p.m. Mountain Time. I'll be doing a live Q&A. Any leftover questions or anytime you want to send questions in between, just send them to webinar@evoketherapy.com. That's it. Man.